Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal system. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we jump into the Georgia criminal cases against rapper Young Thug. We will talk about his eventual plea and his sentence, but we'll also delve into the crazy trajectory of this trial that lasted for over a year. In October, rapper Young Thug, his real name is Jeffrey Williams. pleaded guilty in Atlanta to gang, drug, and gun charges a year after a racketeering trial had begun. He pleaded to one gang charge, three drug charges, and two other gun charges. He also entered no contest pleas to another gang charge and a racketeering conspiracy charge. He's a 33-year-old Grammy winner, and he was sentenced by Fulton County's Superior Court Judge Paige Reese Whitaker to a very interesting sentence. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison, the first five to be served in prison, but commuted for the time that he had already served. He'd already served 567 days in jail. He was put on in 15 years probation. If he successfully completes probation, then another 20 years of his sentence will be commuted. If he violates his probation, then he serves the 20 years. The conditions of his probation are unique, to say the least. He's to stay away from the Atlanta metro area, which is his home, during his first 10 years of probation, except for weddings, funerals, graduations, or serious illness of family members. That's number one. He is, however, to return four times a year to make live anti-gang, anti-gun violence presentations at schools or community organizations serving children. And if he does that, that would count towards his 100 hours of community service to be performed each year during his probation. The judge cautioned him about young people emulating the lyrics of his song, so he's been put on notice to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. He's agreed to be searched at any time, to undergo random drug testing, and to refrain from promoting gangs in any way, and that would mean also in the lyrics that he uses. He's also ordered to avoid associating with gang members, excluding a guy by the name of Unfook, I guess it's UNFOOK, and Gunna. Those are rappers that are signed to his label. Judge, that's long-winded, and I apologize, but this is, you and I have sentenced people. And we've given people probation and suspended sentences, but nothing like this.
You are so right. But I want to start by just congratulating you on your pronunciation of the non-governmental names of the parties.
thank you.
You did. You did as good a job as you could, even this is your very, you know, limited exposure to rap. And so, you know, I will say, first of all, this was a request.
No. Let me just correct something right off the bat. I was introduced to rap I spent 2 years doing play-by-play broadcasting for Ohio University women's basketball. And I traveled with the team for two seasons.
Well, there it is.
I was introduced to rap a while ago.
Right. You know, you probably know some of the best and brightest in the business.
The old school. Yeah.
And probably before we others began to term it as gangster rap, right? And so, interestingly, part of the underpinning, and we'll get to that as we talk about the complexity of this case, which may extend even beyond this particular episode, but part of the complexity of this case was a question about whether or not there was the criminalization of free speech through rap music, and how this may target some individuals, particularly young, Black, African-American rappers versus others, and how, you know, this might stymie creativity and lead to, you know, less creative or broad release of good music or new music in the industry. And that was actually, I think, a legitimate concern, because for those artists who were not involved in this case, they kind of took that as kind of a bellwether or a signal that they too could be targeted because of, you know, lyrics that they created that may in fact be based in fantasy or, you know, nothing at all, but certainly could come back to haunt them in a criminal setting. But as to your point about the fashioning of this sentence from Judge Whitaker, I thought this was extremely creative, which is, you know, what I think you were going for in acknowledging this. Now, if it's creative for the charges, I think, again, that's a different story. This case had already, as you said, been underway. The trial had already begun. The evidence was already coming in. And given the nature of the offenses, now, let's be clear, we were talking about original charges of weapons and drug offenses, gang involvement, racketeering, and for Mr. Williams, aka Young Thug, he was actually charged with leading a criminal street gang. You know, the RICO charge, which stands for Racketeering Influence and Corruption Organization Act, this is a charge that had traditionally been reserved for mafia members. And yet in Fulton County, Georgia, this same offense was now being applied to the defendant, as well as 29 others. This was about a 30 there. The number of defendants that started off in this case was about 30. And so it bears to reason that in going through a trial, and Judge, you know this because we've done this before, you go through a trial, you can get all kinds of surprises. And you get the, you know, the Matlock surprises when there's a, you know, surprise witness behind the door, or somebody just says something on the stand that nobody ever expected. And that too creates something. And so I wonder if the judge's response by way of sentencing was maybe in response to you know, some information that was borne out in trial, because the nature of the offenses themselves as they were charged, and especially comparing that to what he eventually or ultimately pled to, meaning Mr. Williams pled to, that is, you know, there's an awful lot of daylight when you're talking about weapons, guns, gang involvement, which usually involves violence and the like. Usually there's no escaping a long term of incarceration. And yet, even though the defendant, Young Thug, had been incarcerated pre-trial and had been denied bail, much like
three times.
It sounds very similar to some to another case that we talked about a few weeks ago, right? For similar reasons, which is the judge was concerned about the safety of the community while the matter was pending. And given the nature of the charges, folks, you should understand that these are things judges take into consideration, that whether or not, you know, the community is going to be safe if the defendant is released while these matters are pending. I think there was one instance while this case was going on that a potential witness had actually been stabbed while incarcerated, and there was maybe a new charge of attempted murder that was added because of that. And again, so when the judge decided to fashion this sentence, Judge Whitaker, I think it's extremely thoughtful. I just wonder if it is truly responsive to what was at least initially perceived to be kind of the heinousness of these charges, even though the defendant has spent some time behind bars. Yes, a 40-year sentence, first five in prison, but that being commuted, and then probation, which also can be commuted if the defendant kind of walks a tightrope, is amazing. It starts by requiring essentially the defendant to relocate. He's got to leave. He's got to leave home and can only return in these very, very limited circumstances. That's pretty amazing. And has to do that for a decade. Now, for someone who maybe is you know, financially stable as this defendant is, it may not be a problem. He may already have multiple residences. But I like to look at these through the lens of the average defendant or the average person and ask how many people could uproot themselves for a decade, live somewhere else, and only return home under certain circumstances at very easily. And that probably isn't a whole lot of folks. But I suspect the judge did it on purpose.
I think as well that she did. Just a couple of clarifications. Young Thug created his own record label, YSL, if you've ever seen that. And it's
stands for Young Slime Live.
No. The record label stood for
Young Stoner Life, correct.
And at the same time, he was alleged to have created a violent criminal street gang called YSL. Young Slime Life.
Yes, the Slimers.
Interesting, in reading about this case, the New York Times had an interesting article. And it was inferring without saying that the conditions of the probation here are so detailed and so many of them that it's really setting Young Thug up to fail. And that the judge, in trying to look magnanimous, really is dooming him to 20 years in prison because there's no way anybody can follow all of these. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I respectfully disagree because I think that a judge who goes through the steps of being this thorough, this detailed, this explicit, leaving little, if no room for interpretation or misinterpretation, very, very clear about what the court's expectations are, is purposely engaging this exercise to put the defendant on notice of how they should govern themselves. Now, I think when you start talking about the idea of setting them up for failure, I think that goes to this idea or this sentiment that the defendant already has, you know, criminal proclivities and they just cannot help themselves. And so if you start requiring that they modify their lives and their behavior, they're never going to be able to do that. And since they won't, you're just waiting for a reason to punish them anyway. Well, truthfully, the court could do that without going through all of the steps that have been outlined here. The court could merely impose that the term of incarceration. It could do that without it. Remember, it takes extra effort to go through what Judge Whitaker did. It takes an extraordinarily it takes an extraordinary amount of clarity to outline all of these expectations because in my view, the court is doing it for a reason. They're trying to create an atmosphere that says, hey, listen, yes, you could go to prison. I am going to give you the keys to the prison door. They only unlock when these terms are violated. you can hold these keys for the duration of the time that we have this engagement. So if it's 20 years or 15 years or 40 years, I'm not the one that's triggering the door to be unlocked. You're holding the keys and you unlock the door anytime these terms are violated. But it remains locked as long as these terms are not violated. So I just think the New York Times has it. Maybe they don't fully appreciate the efforts that judges go through in formulating very specific sentences like this. Now, the flip side is, and Judge, I think you know this, the flip side is there are those for whom we will give many, many, many an opportunity.
Yeah.
And no matter what, and no matter how many safeguards you put in place for their benefit, they're going to find a way to unlock that door. And I would say, you know, I used to have defendants when I would think, you know what, I don't know if this is the right thing to do or not. I know that this is a case that, you know, is serious, but maybe not the most serious. So I'm going to rule this way. And one thing I would tell you, for some of those individuals, I would always think, you know what? This is the kind of person that'll give me another chance if I didn't get it right, because I'm going to see them again. And that's not, I mean, that should not be a point of pride, but it is a point of reality. How many times have you had defendants who've used the courtroom doors like a turnstile? Yeah. And they, you know, kind of rifle in and out? But I don't believe that, again, a judge whose time is extremely precious, and given every, this is Judge Whitaker, remember, if you know this or not, Judge Whitaker was the third judge on this case.
Yes, yes.
You had two prior judges that had, for different reasons, had recused. You had a defense attorney that was held in contempt. This was a very complicated and detailed and engaged case. And so by the time Judge Whitaker got this case, it still went forward to trial, and the plea was actually mid-trial. It wasn't as if it were at the beginning, even doing voir dire, nor had they gotten to the end. So I'm inclined to believe that Judge Whitaker was probably thinking, if in fact this matter were to resolve, if it resolved with a plea, here are some of the things that I think could be in place, or I think would be a good response to this behavior. Not, hey, here's how I'm going to set up a trap door for the defendant to fall through and waste my time all over again, because I just don't think they're going to do it. So I'm going to fashion a sentence to save face for everyone. It's going to pacify the prosecution. It's going to make the defense feel like they earned their retainer, and everybody's going to walk away free and clear. And then I'll give it a year or two or three, and no doubt the defendant's going to walk into my trap door and I'll see them all again. I don't know a judge who does that.
Also, I want to make a couple of things clear in for our audience, and you can jump in here as well. If somebody is accused of violating their probation, any one of these many conditions that Judge Whitaker put out, they don't go to prison automatically. Has to be a motion filed by the government to revoke their probation. And then there is a hearing before the judge, the sentencing judge, in this case, Judge Whitaker, for her to decide whether it was a major violation, a minor violation, whether the conditions ought to be tweaked. So she has an ongoing relationship with this defendant throughout the next 15 years.
Indeed. And you're absolutely right, Judge. It's entirely possible that in event that any one of these terms of the probation is violated or alleged to have been violated, because there can also be mistakes in fact or mistake in law. There can be, you know, remember that the judge may outline these very specific terms, but it's not the judge personally that's overseeing the daily compliance of the defendant. That is often relied upon by a probation department. And so if you have a probation department that's reading a certain term or condition that says, for example, the defendant has to make anti-violence presentations at schools and maybe community centers for, you know, four times a year, but then separately sees that there's a 100-hour community service obligation, but doesn't, and the defendant does the 4 times a year, but doesn't do the extra 100 hours of community service. And therefore, a probation violation is filed because, according to the probation officer, the defendant did not complete 100 hours of community service, even though they did the presentations at the schools. That may be a error in interpretation on the part of the probation officer under those circumstances. You could have a probation officer that, instead of reading those two terms or conditions together or giving the defendant credit for those public presentations, is interpreting them as two very separate things. And so that could be a cause for a request to revoke or to take back the probation and impose a term of incarceration. What else should be understood is that not every violation or alleged violation, as you said, Judge, is considered a major violation, that even if it's identified as a violation, you may have the probation department that says, Judge, this doesn't warrant incarceration, but maybe it does warrant something else. For example, if he's ordered to randomly drug test and he's determined to have illegal drugs in his system, it may be more appropriate that he get an assessment and be treated as opposed to being incarcerated. Right. Because we know that you're not likely going to get intensive treatment for addiction while you are incarcerated. And so if the court's real goal is to ensure that the defendant remains drug and alcohol free, and if they're randomly tested and found that those substances are in their body, the court would be wise to approach this just similarly as they did the terms of probation, which is, hey, let's deal with the root cause issue. If we believe the root cause issue here is gang activity, gang affiliation, then let's turn this all around and have you doing something positive. Well, the same for, you know, substance abuse and substance use treatment. If we believe, or if the court believes, that you are now engaged in illegal drug or alcohol activity, then you'll probably do well to get that behavior assessed and treated, as opposed to just, you know, again, pulling that trap door. And like, any small thing you do wrong, you're going to go to prison. And I want our listeners to kind of manage their expectations for the judge, right? It doesn't mean the judge isn't tough on crime. It means that judges are thoughtful and perhaps not knee-jerk and are not just looking to what I call the nuclear option, which I consider incarceration the nuclear option. Right. If they've exercised other options beforehand, they can continue to moderate and take a step-by-step approach to how they respond to even what's perceived as probation term violations.
So I have one of the terms that bothers me a little bit, and let me bring it up. And that's refraining from promoting gangs in any way. If you're a hard-ass probation officer who is monitoring young thug for the next 15 years, you're going to be looking at the lyrics of everything that he produces himself or that his record company produces. And you could be nitpicky to the nth degree on whether or not lyrics promote gangs or gang activity. It's a whole different issue about using the lyrics at a trial, and we'll get to that later. But just since we're talking about probation, do you see that as a point of perhaps further litigation or further court hearing?
I see that, I think, as probably as concerning as any defense attorney would see it as, right? Because
that just had a red light on it for me as a defense attorney.
Because it's also subjective, right? Do you assume that something that's being said or done or posted is gang affiliated? Do you know that to be the case? Do you know whether or not this defendant is intending to convey something that may be a gang signifier or is gang affiliated? It may not be. Here, I'll tell you that, you know, there are, you know, a myriad of Greek organizations, whether they're historically Black or otherwise, and just about every one of them uses signifiers to show or demonstrate their affiliation with a fraternity or a sorority. Is that considered a gang signifier? If in fact it is more closely aligned with a fraternity or a sorority, and I'm not suggesting that the defendant here is you know, aligned with either or.
Right.
But I think it does go to the question and the issue you raised about, you know, how, and the issue that I raised about how or whether you criminalize, you know, lyrics, rap lyrics, creativity, and how you now police it, because that's essentially what this says, is that you need to police it. And unless Young Thug is about to become Reverend Young Thug, and all of his lyrics are now, you know, gospel lyrics that, you know, are the difference between night and day between what he's previously produced and what he's producing now or for the next 15 years, I think there's always going to be the ability, especially given the genre of music that he's in, there's going to be the ability to at least tacitly make those connections, right? Whether you're right or wrong, if you've got some, you know, really, you know, mature probation officer that may not be intimately familiar with rap or how that's used, you may have
just go ahead. An old probation officer
who may not have a real good sense of this, then I promise you, if he's not speaking the King's English, which then goes to criminalizing other behavior, right? So if he's maybe speaking a certain way, it can be interpreted as speaking in code, or, you know, using certain language to signal others. You can always engage in these kind of, you know, weird theories about certain things as basic as communication, or, and again, what does a gang signifier mean? Does it mean something?
It could be colors. It could be colors on an album cover,
right? Or colors on that you're wearing, right? It could be your favorite color. My favorite color is red. Does that mean that I'm with the Bloods? My favorite color is blue. Yeah. Does that mean I'm with the Crips? Is that right. You know, what does that mean? And so, does this man now have to, you know, dress like Steve Jobs? And, you know, is that what's required now? Because if that is the difference between, you know, his freedom and not, then maybe he does. But again, that, as you said, that is troubling, because you leave the subjective interpretation to someone else who may be, you know, maybe trigger happy to penalize. It is possible.
We hope that Judge Whitaker is wise in what she will allow and not allow.
Here's what I'll also say, Judge, is that those probation hearings you talk about, those violation hearings, those are evidentiary hearings.
So
even if it is alleged that the defendant has violated, he's entitled to a hearing where actual evidence is brought forward. This isn't just about parties walking in court and one side saying one thing and another side saying another. He's absolutely entitled to a hearing on the evidence that shows and supports the allegation that the probation has been violated. He does it now. He can, through his attorney, he can just consent to the violation and ask the court to mitigate or lower, you know, the penalty or lessen the penalty that he would face, especially if he believes he has a legitimate explanation for it. For example, if he's, you know, if he's pulled over and arrested with a, you know, a prescription narcotic that he happened to pick up for a sick family member, he may be precluded from being in possession of them. But if he's caring for a family member, it may be a violation on its face, but not an actual violation. He's entitled to that hearing that will allow the judge context and to more fully understand what the nature of the violation is, so that, as you said, Judge, she can make a wise decision about what to do.
This case, there could even be expert testimony about interpretation of rap lyrics.
Oh, yeah.
We're sort of plowing new ground here legally.
Well, if you think you had trouble pronouncing these names, imagine what the names of the experts are going to be. It's going to be every rapper in
I got,
you know,
Gunna North right. America.
Gunna, you did get Gunna right, which, believe it or not, whose real name is Sergio Giovanni Kitchens. Sergio Kitchens, a.k.a. Gunna. G-U-N-N-A, folks. Yes, please buy a vowel. But, I mean, okay.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I think is important before we move on, Judge, and see if you agree with me. And let me use a quick story to bring this forward. When I was a college student, it was in the middle of all kinds of anti-war protests and disturbances, and students were getting arrested daily and brought before the local court at where I was at Ohio University, the local municipal court. And the judge there had a unique way of finding people guilty and then would sentence them. And part of his sentence was to ban them from Athens County, which is where Ohio University was located. Ban them from Athens County. In fact, police officers took some defendants who were found guilty. They would take them to their apartment or dorm room, make sure that they packed up, make sure that they were on a bus, and make sure that they were out of town.
That's a lot of community resources, but okay. Okay.
But the banning somebody from a geographic area as part of the sentence went up to the Ohio Supreme Court. And the Ohio Supreme Court found, rightfully, that it was unconstitutional because it was a restriction on travel. And that was unconstitutional. That was part of the sentence. Here we have, you can't come back to Atlanta as a condition of probation. Can you talk about the difference between those two?
Well, so probation and sentencing are slightly different because your probation is a form of a sentence. It is a condition that is required to be complied with in order to avoid potentially a stricter penalty or a harsher penalty, such as incarceration or, you know, longer probation. And so your case is considered ongoing, and you have an opportunity to avoid the trigger of the more serious penalty.
You could say, I don't want to do it, I'll go to jail.
Correct.
I mean, you'd be stupid, but you could say that.
You know what? Imagine, you know, many folks who, you know, I think comparatively, many folks who in certain communities were imposed, you know, fines and said, hey, I can't pay, so just send me to jail. And so that was not always maybe the smartest choice, but the only one that they had, especially if they didn't have money to pay. Certainly in South Euclid, that is certainly the preference, is that you incarcerate people in order to force them to pay. And not that that's a practice that I engaged in, but certainly it is a practice that the mayor's office, the city council, and I don't know, maybe even the current sitting judge all embrace, which equally is unconstitutional. But you're absolutely right. If as a term of probation, you can make a choice as to how you will kind of manage your life in order to avoid incarceration, as opposed to the court pronouncing a final and ultimate sentence that includes as part of it this limitation or this ban where you have no choice.
A condition of probation gives you that choice.
Yeah. A pronouncement of a sentence is basically strict compliance. You must do it, and you don't have a choice. There is no, you know, point of personal or otherwise negotiation. You cannot do it. You are not permitted to. And I think that was maybe that fine line that the Ohio Supreme Court was speaking to, is that when a judge uses that as a final sentencing condition, or a final sentencing pronunciation or edict or mandate, that's different from if you want to avoid a different penalty, a more enhanced penalty, a harsher penalty, then you must not do, or you must do X, Y, and Z, which may include staying away. Again, that involves personal choice and making that personal decision, which I think is different from just pronouncing the sentence itself.
By the way, the judge that had the ban that was found to be unconstitutional, I went on to law school, came back and practiced law in Athens and ran against him and defeated him. He was a 13-year incumbent, so I guess I got the final, cherry on top of the sundae by defeating
you. You were the cooler head to prevail, Judge. And it was the exact opposite for me, right? I went through complete hell dealing with, a mayor's administration, a city council, and others who had no respect or appreciation for the court and the fact that courts are not ATM machines. They should not be there for the purpose of raising or collecting money for a city, only for them to now, have the jurist in place that they like, because that's exactly what the scheme is to essentially size people up and shake them down for money to pad the city's coffers. And that's why we struggle so hard with people having respect for the rule of law.
Right.
Yeah, and trusting the court, because that's not what it's for. Now, I doubt that, Mr. Williams here, I didn't hear that he was imposed a fine. And so that's pretty interesting.
No, I didn't hear that either.
Because of all the things that, he could have faced, it could have been some kind of fine or financial penalty. Because remember, back in the olden days, the belief is that fines worked as a deterrent. If you, especially when, you were landowners or when you had, very limited means. So the idea is that if we could change your behavior by taking money that you had very little of. And so that made you less likely to do that or engage in that behavior going forward. And, I think that's a school of thought, but it is a school of thought that has, long since passed, because that is just not how folks respond anymore, nor should they be. But between that time and now, you've got your jurisdictions and communities that have essentially, talk about addiction problems, you've got communities that have become kind of addicted to the amounts of money that courts can raise by imposing fines. And so if you had someone like Mr. Williams as a defendant in your court, who's a multimillionaire many times over and has just been found guilty, there would probably be nothing that made your city or your community happier than to impose a really hefty fine that they can pay, because courts aren't banks, so they don't get the money. The money goes to the jurisdiction. And so for them, that as an additional form of punishment would have been, I will tell you right now, in the community I sat in, that would have been music to their ears. They would have been there rubbing their hands together. It won't change his behavior. And insofar as he and others were charged with everything from criminal conspiracies to armed robbery and murder, it won't make a victim whole, and it won't make anyone dead come back to life, but it would certainly make the people who are trying to balance the scales of justice with nickels and dimes, it would make them happy. But that's interesting. Judge Whitaker didn't impose anything like that.
And everything on here, Judge, all the conditions that we went through, are all intended to change behavior.
Exactly.
Change behavior in a positive way, and to reinforce that with the potential of sanction if you don't follow it. But they are behavioral changing things, not just financial cha-ching, let's add to the coffers. Right?
I was just going to say, why do you think Judge Whitaker did not impose a financial penalty? Because she clearly could have, and she could have imposed a hefty one, knowing that it would be paid in seconds.
I think she knew that it could be paid in seconds, and paying a fine does not... I don't think she cared about the coffers. So paying a fine does not alter behavior.
I agree.
It just lowers somebody's bank account.
Right. I mean, tell me how many times you've had a DUI defendant or an abusive defendant who immediately changed their behavior because you imposed a fine?
No, none. Nobody. Nobody. Not even on traffic offenders, multiple traffic offenders. You know, you get five speeding tickets and I'm going to elevate your fine. That doesn't keep somebody from going out and speeding.
Oh, absolutely not.
So I think her concentration was on changing behavior. Mm-hmm. And using this young man, a 33-year-old young man, as an example of the possibility of changing behavior and using the judicial system as an incentive and an instigator in that change.
And I think that should be applauded, right? Because, and I think that actually undercuts the New York Times argument that the defendant's being set up for.
Yeah, I think it does as well. And as I've read that, I thought, you know, as a judge, this judge is being thoughtful. This judge is trying to come up with, I mean, the prosecution asked for a humongous amount of jail time. The defendant did not. This was created by the judge. This wasn't a recommendation of the prosecutor and the judge went, oh, yeah, or a recommendation of the defense. And the judge said, yeah, no. This was created by the judge and she had a purpose in doing it.
And what folks should understand is that when judges, and it happens very frequently, that judges receive sentencing recommendations, not just from the prosecution, but from the defense as well. They will often not only argue in court, but they'll memorialize it in a motion to the court to explain why they believe that maybe the prosecution's request for a very harsh term or penalty is off key or off base. Oftentimes, though, a court can ask, and we saw this in the Trump case, the court can ask for what's called a pre-sentencing investigation, where the defendant sits with probation and they are interviewed, more information is learned, and probation can make recommendations or suggestions to the court for an appropriate sentence. Now, I don't know which of these three elements that the judge relied upon, if any, but I am with you in that I see in crafting these probation terms a process that was just leaps and bounds away from knee-jerk. It was thoughtful.
It was thoughtful.
It was methodical. It was responsive to a lot of things. Clearly, the judge recognized that the defendant, young thug, has talent and that he is seen as a role model, especially to young people. And so making the anti-violence presentations, whether it's at schools or community centers or organizations, was a purposeful and thoughtful way that the judge wanted to take, his craft and use it in a way that could positively influence those who she's now aware he has the ability to directly influence. You know, I would tell defendants when I had them in court and it would be repeated times over and over again, I would often lament and say, if only you could use your powers for good and not evil. And this is a way I think that the judge purposely kind of took this situation and said, okay, we're going to figure out how to use your talents, your powers for good. And again, this wasn't something that's, oh my gosh, I know he's not going to do it. So the minute he doesn't do four presentations this year is when I'm going to, immediately sentence him to prison. In fact, I don't even know that for this particular term, this probation term, the anti-violence presentations, I don't know that the judge required that they be given in the Atlanta area. I think that, they could be given in a number of places because the defendant is permitted to travel because he travels for work. So he could travel and give those, which means she appreciated that his reach is expansive, right? She knows that it's not just the people in the backyard there in Fulton County that's listening to them. This man became a multimillionaire because he is known and he is, he's revered by especially young people nationwide and worldwide. And so that means that the ability to take this and to have a positive impact, like an exponential impact, is even greater for them. I think that the New York Times got it all wrong when they suggested that this was merely an effort to set him up for failure. I think it is an effort to respond to his behavior, but at the same time, create some terms and conditions that will turn his negative experience and exposure into something positive, hopefully making him understand how responsible he is to his fan base and to the public, and also to society in general.
Well, the headline on the New York Times story was "Banned from Atlanta, the challenges of Young Thug's unique probation." The rapper was released from jail last week after a surprise guilty plea for 15 years. A set of strict requirements will govern his life and his music. You know, and then it goes on, and basically inferring that he isn't going to be able to follow the conditions. Yeah,
and that also kind of suggests that, you know, he's doomed to a life of crime, right?
He can't get it together. That's the way I read it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the change is not possible.
Right, and I think that's insulting to a judge that takes that much time to try to say, hey, here's how we're going to try to right this ship, right? We're going to try to hit the reset button and see if we can't get this. Let me tell you, this defendant is young. I mean, his name is Young Thug, but he is. Yeah, he's in his early 30s. So he's got, by all accounts, he's got an awful lot of life ahead of him. I do not understand why there would be some supposition that he cannot turn the corner on this. And that's, insofar as the language kind of, you know, has you believe that it's a woe is me type of article, that he's being banned from all of these things, it also at the same time just kind of sounds like we don't expect more.
But let me just get down to it. I think it's white mainstream media saying this guy's a thug and he's not going to be able to change.
Ah, and the judge just set him up for failure. So he's, you know, why not just send him where he's going to be anyways, as opposed to waiting?
This is all a waste of time because he's not going to be able to change.
He won't comply.
Right.
And that's insulting too. That's insulting.
It's very insulting. You know, it's I think the height of insulting. We've got about 10 minutes left or so, and I want to just start on the trial. We're not going to make it all the way through, but let me ask you, if I have this right, jury selection began in January of 2023. Now, folks, we're 2 months from January 2025.
Yes.
So January 2023. And jury selection took 10 months. So we're talking about through October of 2023. So then the trial against six remaining defendants started with opening statements that took place in November of 2023. The plea that we've been talking about took place in late October 2024.
That's correct.
This is a long-ass
trial. This is a long trial.
What the hell? 10 months for jury selection?
10 months just for voir dire alone. And
voir dire, by the way, is jury selection for people out there.
Right. And so also let's consider the fact that, you know, this really does test the limits of what a speedy trial is. Right?
Really? Really?
And during this time, you had defendants, particularly Young Thug and Gunna, others who were incarcerated during this time. They were not out and about. They weren't doing concerts. They were not sharing the community.
567 days he was incarcerated.
Indeed. And so with that in mind, there is something to be said for what it means, genuinely what it means to have a speedy trial. And with the jury selection itself taking so long, it certainly can, that can wear down a process, but it was also necessary. And it is necessary when you're selecting jurors to get individuals who, even if they have some appreciation or some knowledge of the defendant or defendants, that they can still be objective, they can be fair, non-biased, because a fair trial is owed not just to the defendant, but also to the state. And when you have high profile defendants, I don't recall exactly how long it took to seat a jury for the Trump trial in New York. It did not take 6 months, I mean, 10 months. I know that.
No, it didn't take 10 months. It was a couple of weeks, I think.
It did take a couple weeks. And because it took a couple weeks, we still ended up getting the trial underway. But I absolutely, when I read that and I saw that and I said, my goodness, this is a very long trial. Because also consider the fact that, again, this case began with 30 defendants citing or referring to more than 180 instances of criminal behavior. I think ultimately the indictment itself had nearly 60 charges or 56 counts in the indictment itself. And so having to go through kind of an overview of all of that with a jury pool, no doubt it's going to take time. 10 months seems to be a record of sorts. I don't know of a trial where it took longer to seat a jury, but this absolutely is one of the longer ones.
Just think of the cultural dynamics. I mean, this is in Fulton County, Georgia, a very diverse area, but just think of the dynamics of this. You know, do you have old white guys, trying to understand the whole concept of rap lyrics? Do you have street people who understand? I mean, the jury selection process to get the ideal jury that would be able to interpret this from a prosecution or a defense standpoint would be a real challenge.
You're absolutely right. Imagine, what it took to get the defense attorney up to speed on all of this. I can't imagine. But I don't know that the prosecutors are necessarily more street savvy. This is, I think both the prosecution and the defense have some really deep appreciation for the legal contours of the charges, which we can go into on a later episode. But being able to relate that to and marry that to this world of music, entertainment, art expression, no doubt you've got issues of First Amendment rights, right? I mean, if you're an artist and particularly an artist of color, and in this case alone was raised the issue of whether or not there's the criminalization of art expression by certain groups of folks, particularly Black rappers. And if you're going to use rap lyrics to prosecute someone, how do you use that, and how do you determine that it's anything more than fantasy speak, right? Or
the judge made a good example, and I want to give it back to you, but just on that point, she said that young people view rap music like they do World Federation Wrestling. Mm-hmm. That they don't know that it's fake. They don't know that it's art. They don't know that it's an art form and it's not for real.
Correct.
Whereas adults, or most adults, are more discerning about, wrestling's good theater, but it's not real. And the lyrics are an artful expression, as you mentioned, and don't necessarily reflect reality. I thought that was really essential in all of this.
Oh, absolutely. Because again, it's and it's also not a new art form, but but I think the argument is that, you know, artists, rappers, songwriters, whomever, are not entering the profession or the arena of entertainment expecting that their craft may one day be weaponized against them. And that's not a thought, right? And like you said, just like you're talking about, you know, the fact that you have so many young people who view rap the same way you view kind of, you know, WWE is, you know, they don't know that it's fake, or they don't know that not all of it is real. Also understand that the audience often are younger people who are still going through brain development. So their ability to discern what is actually real versus not real is further limited by the fact that, you know, not only have they not experienced full maturation, that they also are going through brain development, and that presents its own challenge. And to kind of hold the artist to that standard, as if they know the hands in which all of their art will ever land in, is fairly unreasonable, which, by the way, I think may also have gone to why the judge fashioned the sentence the way that she did. I think, you know, a lot of this can kind of go back to how did we end up, and I think starting at sentencing is just a brilliant place to start this discussion, because there's so much about this case that I think can tie back to that. Because understanding this, understanding, as I said before, the reach of the artists, who they're able to connect with, who's listening to them, who's following them, who they're being the pipers to, does come with a responsibility. And so that's fine. But you're also talking about the fact that, you know, Young Thug himself was 33, yes, at the time that this matter concluded, but he wasn't 33 when he first started rapping. He wasn't 33 when the trial first started. So by all accounts, heck, we're talking about somebody young who was still going through brain development.
Yeah. My wife said no man has brain development till they're at least 40. And then she puts a question mark on it.
So. Now you tell me that. So now my anxiety about my son can subside. I have been waiting for the longest to wake up and to believe that it's the full development has occurred. So thank you for managing my expectations.
You know, let's give a preview and let me just hit some points of what we're going to be talking about in this complicated case in the future. We had the original judge who denied bail. He had to recuse himself. There was a whole kerfuffle about him having a secret meeting with a prosecutor and a witness outside of the defense attorney being present. That same judge held the defense attorney in contempt for failing to divulge the source of the information about the secret meeting. A prosecutor investigator was accused of sexually harassing a witness. That same witness was then arrested and put in jail as a material witness on a material witness warrant, something that we really have to dig into for people. And then to top it off, the whole controversy of rap lyrics as part of the evidence and the First Amendment issues. What have I missed? There's got to be other things.
Oh, there are others, but those are the highlights. Remembering there was a second judge after the initial judge was assigned, that's right. The second judge that was assigned and also recused as it related to an improper relationship between a deputy that was formally assigned to the court and one of the defendants. And then, you know, finally then to Judge Whitaker, who I said earlier was the third judge assigned to this case.
Thank God she was wise.
And I think it's important to talk about, again, the different charges that some of the defendants have pled to. Out of the 30, there are several that have pled to charges. Right. They're several of them whose cases are resolved. This is, and how this has impacted the community, the rap community in general. There are folks, I think, on both sides of this argument about whether or not pleas can or should be taken and whether there are repercussions personally or professionally when cases resolve this way versus boxing it up or waiting for the jury to return a verdict and knowing that sometimes what you're facing is essentially a gamble of how a jury might decide a case. And I think it also is reasonable for us to at some point talk about what we might see happening with the remaining defendants. There are several defendants still remaining,
right,
in this case. And I guess with all the fireworks that have happened with the other cases, you can expect more here. And how about the use of the RICO statute by the Fulton County Prosecutor's Office, who I think, you know, in nationwide is kind of leading the way on using the RICO statute.
They used it against cases. An education issue. They used it in the Trump case that yep. we've talked about. They've used it in this case.
Yes.
They've really developed that as sort of their go-to massive charge.
Precisely. And I think folks might benefit from understanding kind of the difference in how it's been used across these three. And yes, because you're hearing the same charge over and over again, sometimes it can become confusing as to how you can use this same charge related to teachers versus the former president, now president-elect, versus a, you know, alleged street gang. Those are all very different groups of people and very different individuals, but they were all facing a similar charge, this Racketeering Influence and Corruption Organization Act, or RICO Act charge. And I think it's worthy of breaking that down and comparing it so that you can understand how the Fulton County Prosecutor's Office is using this as a very sharpened tool to respond to what they believe is criminal behavior.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, and we'll do this in a number of episodes till we work our way through it. This is a fascinating case coming from state courts that has nothing to do with politics, but a lot to do with culture. You know, I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so we're looking forward to bringing this back to you, but we do invite you to continue to follow us. Tune in, because every subsequent episode, whether about this or something else, is going to be equally exciting. You can find us on any platform where you find your favorite podcasts, including and starting with our primary sponsor, that being WOUB and NPR. You can also find us on Amazon, Spotify, Apple, Audible, or again, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast, because as we've said before, we continue to believe that you don't trust what you don't understand. And our hope is that by engaging you in this manner, we have improved your understanding of these court processes. And now you'll trust us more.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to us. You can do that at my email address, which is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. And if you also have topics that you'd like for us to cover in the future, please shoot us an email and we'll try to accommodate you. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and legal procedures. Until that time, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks. We'll be right back.